My name is Katie Kelso and I am the Solicitor in Charge of Care and Protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today and the land on which you might be listening from today and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Today I am really honoured to be joined by two very special guests. The first is the President of the Children's Court, Judge Peter Johnston. The second is Kyron McGrath, Solicitor at the Aboriginal Legal Service. We have brought these fantastic guests today together for a podcast on working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families in care and protection matters. The importance of this topic really cannot be overstated given that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children continue to be significantly overrepresented in child protection and out-of-home care services compared to non-Indigenous children, and that Aboriginal children and young people in New South Wales are still around 9 times more likely to be in out-of-home care than their non-Indigenous peers. Today we are going to cover the legislative framework, the case law, take a bit of a closer look at the Aboriginal child placement principles and get some top tips for working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. Your Honour, if I can start with you, can we start with the principles of the Children and Young Persons Care and Protection Act, which of course are relevant to practitioners at all stages and to the court of care proceedings and to all decisions being made under the Act. Can you set the scene and take us through these important principles?
Yes, thanks Katie, and if I can also acknowledge the traditional occupiers of the lands on which we meet, pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. The Act has to be understood in the context that it's a piece of legislation that relates not just to judicial proceedings but also to administrative decisions. So it guides everybody associated with issues arising in relation to the care and protection of children. The starting point in any discussion is always section 9(1) of the Act, which contains the paramountcy principle, which requires the court and administrative decisions to be made having regard to the safety, welfare and well-being, which is the paramountcy principle, or often referred to as the paramountcy principle. And what a lot of people don't understand is that that principle applies in relation to all decisions to be made in relation to children, even if it conflicts with the rights of parents. The rights of the parents are subject to that overriding principle, and it is the interests of the child which are paramount. So that's the starting point. But there are, as you know, in section 9(2), a series of other principles that are to be applied consistent with the paramountcy principle that apply to children, and one of the important ones, in my view, having regard to what Katie Kelso mentioned in terms of the overrepresentation of Aboriginal families in the system, is section 9(2)(d), which talks about culture and the importance of taking into account the name, the identity, language, cultural and religious ties so far as possible in terms of preserving them for the purposes of the child's upbringing. So the need by the court in particular and solicitors representing all parties involving Aboriginal children in the system is that the children's culture and the participation of their families must be applied across all aspects of the decision-making process. Right from the outset, that means from the first engagement with the families throughout the course of the proceedings until a final decision is made, and thereafter until the child obviously becomes an adult.
It's a very important point. Your Honour, can you also talk to us about self-determination and participation? What do sections 11 and 12 tell us, and what do we need to know as practitioners coming before the Children's Court?
Yes, so what has to be understood in the context of the Care Act is that there are specific provisions that relate to Aboriginal people, and everybody needs to be cognizant of these principles and take them into account when dealing with any children who may be being considered either having been removed or having or there being some early intervention in a family that is Aboriginal, which caseworkers, lawyers and everybody associated with the process need to understand. And in sections 11 and 12 of the Act, these are sections that refer to the rights of Aboriginal children, parents and family members to participate in the decision-making for Aboriginal children. Their right to self-determination is enshrined not only in international law but also in the Care Act in those sections. It is a principle to be applied in the administration of the Act in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that they should be allowed to participate in the care and protection of their children with as much self-determination as is possible. To assist in the implementation of that principle, the Minister may negotiate and agree with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to the implementation of programs and strategies that promote self-determination. And I think those were the sorts of principles that were referred to by the in the report of Megan Davis in the Family as Culture report. And I'm not sure that a lot of that actually has occurred in the past, although happily I think it's starting to occur more and more. Secondly, under Section 12, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, kinship groups, representative organisations and communities are to be given the opportunity to participate in all decisions made concerning the placement of their children and young persons and in other significant decisions made under the Act. So what all this means is that when investigating families or working with families where children are considered to be at risk or where there's an early intervention in a family where there are indications of the possibility of children needing to be removed or removal being considered, caseworkers need to very carefully understand that the principles of the Act require to give the Aboriginal groups as much capacity to participate in the decision-making process as possible.
And I think the sections of the Act that you need to have in the forefront of your mind, whether you're acting for parents or for children. Kyron, can I hand over to you and get your take on these sections and why they're important?
So the principles outlined in sections 11 and 12 impress as important principles that facilitate the involvement of Aboriginal families and community members in decisions about their children. But whilst they express important principles, the sections are somewhat underutilised, I would say, and limited in their scope because they're drafted with caveats. So His Honour's obviously just given a rundown of sections 11 and 12. But section 11 in particular, in relation to self-determination, says that Aboriginal peoples are to participate in the care and protection of their children with as much self-determination as is possible. And so it doesn't articulate that self-determination is a right, and it does not require the state to do anything substantive to enforce compliance with that principle. Section 12, similarly, it allows for participation of Aboriginal families and communities by means approved by the minister. And so it's the minister who is the gatekeeper to our ability to participate in those decisions. And the minister determines how Aboriginal families in the child protection space participate in those important decisions about their children. And of course, as His Honour's just mentioned, that was touched upon in the Family as Culture Review by Megan Davis and her team. And that report found that the right to self-determination, meaning the right of Indigenous peoples to determine their political, economic, social and cultural status, is not currently applied in the Aboriginal child protection system in New South Wales. It's further found that the frequent use of the language of self-determination without appropriate structural recognition creates unrealistic expectations and sets a low bar in which power is retained by the state. We have some recent developments in the child protection space around family group conferencing, so that is a way for Aboriginal families and communities to be involved in the decisions made by their children. But we think that it's there's a long way to go to giving real participation and self-determination for Aboriginal communities and families. That being said, sections 11 and 12 do exist. They are important principles, and we as practitioners can use them to press the department to actually speak to our communities and to our families when we're making decisions for our children. And also, I suppose, in an early intervention space, I think they're important as well when we're assisting families, because there's sections that we can take the department to their caseworkers to and say, hey, these sections exist. You know, we understand that you're involved with this family, and perhaps we want to open the space for this family to be able to participate in the decisions you're making for their children and give them real self-determination around that process.
And both of you have referred to the Family as Culture report prepared by Megan Davis, and while it's a long report, it's certainly something that I would commend to the listeners to read. It's a very important report with incredible level of detail and some fantastic recommendations as to how we can do things better for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. So if you have the opportunity, I'd highly suggest that you give that a read. Your Honour, we might move on to Section 13 and the placement principles. Can you run through these for our listeners and for our practitioners? in terms of the important messages and things that they need to know about these principles.
Yes, well, Section 13, again, is a section that is inserted into the Act specifically to deal with situation of Aboriginal children in the care system. And it provides for a general order for placement for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, the aim being to ensure that, if possible, and assessed as safe, Aboriginal children and young people are placed with their biological family, their extended family, and if not, then with local Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander communities, or the wider Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander communities and culture. The purpose is also to enhance and preserve the children's sense of their Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identity and to ensure a child's right to be raised in their own culture. So if a child is Aboriginal or a Torres Strait Islander, the Children's Court will not make a final order unless it's satisfied that the permanency planning for the child has been given appropriate consideration to the Section 13 placement principles. And what we require now is for the care plan to actually articulate what's been done, if you like, to make sure that those principles have been applied. The principles outline the general order for children who need to be placed in statutory out-of-home care if they're Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander children, as well as the requirements for ensuring that a child or young person's connection with their culture is maintained. Essentially, the order for placement is, firstly, as indicated, with a member of the child's extended family or kinship group if they can't be restored to a parent. Secondly, a member of the Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander community to which the child belongs. Or thirdly, a member of some other Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander family residing in the vicinity of the child or young person's usual place of residence. Then there's some more technical provisions in that section which deal with persons to be approved by the secretary after consultation with members of the child's extended family or kinship group. But I don't think we need to go into the detail of that today.
People can read the section for themselves, can't they?
Yes. So if a child has one Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander parent and one non-Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander parent, the child may be placed with the person with whom the best interests of the child will be served, having regard to the principles of the Act. That's set out in Section 13.4. Arrangements must be made to ensure the child has the opportunity for continuing contact with the other parent's family, community and culture. That ensures that the child's Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander culture and their ability to immerse themselves and learn that culture is preserved, even if they are placed with non-Aboriginal parents. In determining placement, account is to be taken of the child's expressed wishes and whether they identify as an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person.
Kyron, can I hand over to you? Can you talk us through what this means for practitioners at a practical level, on a day-to-day children's court level?
Look, I think it's interesting that within these principles we have a reference to practicality and a child's best interests. So we say if a child can't be placed in compliance with 13.1a, so a member of a child's extended family, their Aboriginal family or kinship group, then we say if that's not practical or in their best interest, then we place in compliance with 1b, and then we go on and on like that. And I think that's interesting because I think we need to realise that it's important to acknowledge that a child's cultural identity is intrinsic to their well-being and how we construct what their best interests are. So we're looking at principles that apply to kids who are placed in statutory out-of-home care, which essentially means that the placement of the principles apply once an interim order is made by the court or within 2 weeks of the removal of a child from their parents. The principles are about so much more than just the placement of an Aboriginal child. They are about enhancing an Aboriginal child's sense of Aboriginal identity and their self-identity. So it's important for children to be around other Aboriginal people because it means that they are assisted in constructing their personal identity, their identity within their family structure, their identity within society. And it's also, I would say, important as well because, I mean, living in a post-colonial society as we are, Aboriginal children need the ability to navigate racism in our society, and oftentimes being with their own people, they learn strategies to do that. But I think in terms of Section 13 itself, we need to be vigilant in guarding against a simplistic approach to Section 13. So where the argument is about the applicability of Section 13.1, for instance, it morphs into this idea that 13.1 doesn't need to apply because it's subject to the objects and the principles of the Act. Whereas if that's the case, there needs to be a sound articulation of precisely what principles and objects and what are the specific facts and circumstances of the case that mean that we can't place in compliance with the hierarchy. Because oftentimes we find, you know, it's just like, well, we're not placing with this Aboriginal family because it's not in their best interest. Whereas there needs to be evidence before the court to articulate, well, why isn't it in their best interest? Why didn't we actually follow the hierarchy? But I think the most important takeaway from Section 13 is that it's about maintaining an Aboriginal child's connection to their culture. And Aboriginal people are best placed to do that. It's the child's Aboriginal family and their community. And so the best thing we can be doing is placing Aboriginal kids with their own family and community, with robust contact arrangements for children to spend time with the family that they don't live with. I mean, really, Section 13 should marry up with Sections 11 and 12. So if we're striving to maintain a child's connection to culture and we're trying to maintain that connection in a meaningful way, we need to properly consult with Aboriginal people and allow Aboriginal families and communities to participate in those decisions, as we've been saying before. And that requires meaningful consultation with Aboriginal communities and families to work out what are this Aboriginal child's best interests. It doesn't mean consulting with internal Aboriginal caseworkers. It means going out into the community and speaking to that community and speaking to the family about what they understand their child's needs and their cultural needs to be. It also requires the state to recognise how Aboriginal people construct their own understanding of family. So Aboriginal families rarely fit the mould of a nuclear family, as we know. So just consulting with parents shouldn't amount to adequate consultation, particularly when there are obvious barriers to why parents might not consult with the department. So this means speaking to cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, what we commonly refer to as a wider family network. It also involves bringing the voices of the wider community in and also oftentimes consulting with Aboriginal community organisations. In terms of how we consult, we need to do it in a culturally appropriate manner. We need to understand the needs of the family and the community to feel safe. We need to recognise how this system has traditionally impacted Aboriginal families. Because for our communities, the child protection system is underscored, obviously, by history of child removal. And that will inevitably have an impact on how Aboriginal peoples engage with that process. So we need to be responsive to the needs of Aboriginal people to feel heard and have a voice in these decisions. For practitioners representing clients, in order for us to push for compliance with Section 13, I don't think that we need to just be leaving it up to the department. I think that we need to be taking instructions from our clients on what family and community members are available as placement options and put those options forward to the department. If we look at family who might not be appropriate for placement, that family might be appropriate to connect a child with their culture, to be involved as mentors, to be involved and to have the children exposed to them so that they're learning what it means to be Aboriginal and what their culture actually is. I also think that it's a matter of evidence. So we need to be outlining what steps that we've taken to speak to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and communities so that the court can be satisfied that proper and adequate steps have been taken, particularly when we're looking at circumstances where Aboriginal kids aren't placed with Aboriginal people. It needs to be before the court. We need to know what steps have been taken.
Those are some fantastic tips, Kyron, and I think really the takeaway message there is that all of the things that we're talking about today need to be something more than just a token gesture or a ticker box, and we need to take each family as a family and not treat them as though their situation is the same as any other family that's before the court. And I think in terms of what you've said about, I guess, holding the department accountable but making sure that certain things have happened, those tips are just as relevant for child representatives as well in asking those questions and making sure that all of those things have happened in the best way possible. Your Honour, can I flick back to you just to talk us through permanency planning in Section 78A?
Yes. So I think it's probably fair to say that the issue of permanency planning for Aboriginal children historically has been an area of neglect And as you're probably aware, I've given a number of decisions where I've made it clear that so far as the Children's Court is concerned, that those Section 13 principles and the Section 78A, capital A principles are to be complied with in terms of the preparation of a care plan for an Aboriginal child. We think it's highly important that for every child for whom a care plan is prepared, who is an Aboriginal child, that there needs to be appropriate identification of a cultural action plan that deals with those issues that relate to their background and their culture and their family and their totems and their traditions and all of those things that are important to children to understand their background and their origins. So the new template for the care plan, as you're aware, sets out a number of, if you like, sections in the care plan that have to be filled out and have to be addressed, and we will not approve a care plan anymore that doesn't satisfactorily deal with the issues in Section 13 and address all of those Aboriginal issues that I've just summarised. The care plans, if they don't comply with the Section 13 principles, we encourage the care plan not be approved, and that the department has to then go away and prepare a new care plan to satisfactorily address those issues. So what we've been trying to do is to encourage the departmental caseworkers to start looking at the Aboriginal issues from the outset, not just to start thinking about them when they prepare the care plan or down the track when it's decided that the child has to be placed somewhere other than back with their parents. What we're saying to the caseworkers is these are the things that you should start addressing from the moment you engage with a family. And I was really pleased to hear you say, Kyron, that you see the role there for the solicitors acting for the children in these circumstances to participate in that process and assist. Because a lot of the information that needs to be ascertained and obtained can be very hard to find, particularly where a lot of Aboriginal families have had some of their ancestors removed as a part of the stolen generation. And a lot of the time they don't know who their ancestors are. So it's important to begin to identify from the outset who is the kinship group, who comprises the kinship group, and the extent to which they may be able to participate in the future life of the child. Traditionally, we used to see so many cases where only one or two of the Aboriginal kinship group would be identified, and it was only very late in the piece that it started to emerge that there was another whole side of the family that should have been looked at and considered for placement or for care or for contact or for all those sorts of issues right from the outset. So what we're asking the departmental caseworkers to do is to look at these issues of Aboriginal background right from the outset and to start the investigation process from the moment they become involved with the family.
Kyron, cultural support plans, what should one look like? What should it include? How should one be put together?
I find cultural planning in the child protection space to be really curious because I think we have a disconnect in the way, or rather a disconnect in some of the views in the community as to what a good cultural plan represents. In the template, in the care plan, and that is the result of years of work by people. And I think when I look at that plan, and maybe it's my privilege as being an Aboriginal person, I don't look at that plan and see any difficulties in complying with that plan. I think in the Children's Court we see oftentimes plans that are blank in terms of the introductory elements. So what's our community of belonging? What's our country nation? What are our totems? What are our kinship groups? That might be a reflection of the fact that the family, because of the space that we exist in, so we have stolen generations, intergenerational trauma matters, which we are all aware of by this point, there are good reasons why families don't often have that information. But the realities are is that that family is backed up by a community out there. So Aboriginal families don't exist in isolation of their communities. And if we're properly consulting with Aboriginal people, start with their families, and if that family doesn't have information, then we need to go to the community. We need to ask them to fill out those introductory matters in the care plan, in the cultural plan itself, The other school of thought is that We know words on a paper, so ticking boxes, filling that stuff out, consulting with the community and putting who we've consulted with and what information they gave us and who's going to be involved in implementing this plan. That is not going to amount to a child learning its culture, learning what it means to be Aboriginal, learning how to navigate racism in this country. So I think the best culture planning is done when Aboriginal children are placed within their Aboriginal families. That way Aboriginal children have the benefit of living with their culture every day. It's difficult to separate concepts of family and culture because they are one in the same. And I think the Family as Culture Report says it quite clearly when it says family is culture. We can't develop a culture in isolation of the people who we share that culture with. So the role of family is incredibly important to a child's understanding of their culture and their identity. And those concepts are central to an understanding of what is in an Aboriginal child's best interests. The support plans themselves, because they exist, are important documents. But like I've said, their ability to plan for an Aboriginal child's culture is rendered almost useless when we don't involve Aboriginal family and community in the development of that plan. It is also pointless to tell a child what their community of belonging is, their language group and their totems are, without involving Aboriginal people in assisting that child to understand what those things mean to them. So I think some takeaways are that the plans are important. We need to push for compliance with them. But to back those plans up, we need to have children exposed to Aboriginal people. We need to have children immersed in their culture and exposed to the people who they share that culture with. That is the best cultural planning. So for practitioners, we need to be, like I've said before, we need to be taking those instructions, not just leaving it to the caseworker to get that information from our clients. What's your country? What's your nation? What's your community of belonging? Do it yourself. Give that information to the department. I think it's going to assist their process, but it's also going to assist the subject child.
Karen, when I'm listening to you give those really fantastic tips, I just keep thinking back to Section 11 and Section 12 and how those tie in. I also think what Your Honour said about the importance of doing this work early and engaging with families early is, I think, more likely to result in some really robust cultural plans that are going to meet the needs of children. Your Honour, I'm going to come back to you. We're going to touch on some of the important cases that practitioners should be aware of when they're practicing in this jurisdiction. Can we start with a case that I think Your Honour is going to be very familiar with, the case of DCJ and Fiona Farmer?
Yes, this is one of a series of cases in which I've emphasised the need for the Section 13 principles and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander principles in the Act to be observed in a robust way rather than in a tokenistic way. And whilst I think we've still got some way to go in relation to the compliance with those principles across the whole of New South Wales, I'm pleased to say that in the areas, at least where I sit, such as the mid-north coast and at Parramatta, I think that the practitioners and the caseworkers fully understand now the need to comply with those principles. I can't always speak for other parts of New South Wales, but it's certainly in those areas, there's a very clear indication that the principles need to be complied with. So the Fiona Farmer decision, and of course that's a pseudonym for an anonymised child, I referred to some Victorian case law and spoke to the centrality of cultural identity to an Aboriginal child's best interests and the need for this fact to be acknowledged if the care plans for the children were going to be properly implemented. So what can be taken from those Victorian decisions? It is not sufficient to simply Google the community of belonging for a child or annex a printout of that information to a care plan. It's not good enough to say that the child attends NAIDOC's week celebrations every year. The need to consider a child or a young person's culture and ensure the participation of families and communities in maintaining their connection must be applied across all aspects of child protection decision-making and allow for the connection or that connection to continue into the future. We know that lived culture involves family connections, as Aaron was indicating earlier. Family findings should have occurred and family have been engaged and family engaged at the earliest possible stage. An understanding of Aboriginal kinship systems has grown over the last few years. So one of the things that we are encouraging, and which I think the department has recognised, is that we need to have more Aboriginal people in the system, in particular in the departments, in investigating cultural background and Aboriginal families and kinship groups, because, as you said, Karen, it's very clear that they understand better how it all works. And so the more we can get Aboriginal caseworkers into the system and preparing some of these care plans and interacting with these families, the better. And that's starting to happen, but I think I'd like to see it happen more quickly. So I think the takeaway from that case in particular is that addressing Section 13 principles is not just a tokenistic tick-the-box exercise. It's a fully comprehensive find out the facts and really delve deeply into the child's kinship group and family group to properly address the Section 13 issues.
Absolutely. Do you want to take us quickly through Victoria, re-Victoria and Marcus?
Yes, well, I think the point of Victoria and Marcus, that's a 2010 case, which was probably a case that's more about exceptional circumstances than standard circumstances, which is a case where the children were placed with carers who were not Aboriginal rather than their Aboriginal grandparents, as the court found there was a real risk that those grandparents would actively discourage the children from identifying with their Aboriginal and cultural links, contrary to the purposes and the spirit of the Aboriginal placement principles as set out in Section 13 of the Act. So that Act we need to be aware of. And what it's basically saying is that obviously there will be cases where the paramountcy principle is more important than the Aboriginal placement principles because of the particular circumstances of that case. But I would like to think that by and large the situation that arose in Victoria and Marcus is an exceptional circumstance that would be presenting itself less and less in care and protection.
You would hope it's an infrequent event.
Indeed.
Your Honour, can I lastly get you to talk to us about the recent decision in Hackett and the Secretary, Department of Communities and Justice, which is a 2020 decision?
Yes, well, this is a very important decision, firstly because it's made by the Court of Appeal and therefore has significant application across the board. It needs to be understood that although that decision related to wording in the Adoption Act, the wording was substantially similar, if not exactly the same, as the wording set out in the Children's Care and Protection Act. And so from our perspective, it will be a decision that's applied in the Children's Court when the issue of Aboriginality arises. I was discussing with Karen earlier as to whether or not that issue arises very often, and I didn't think it did, but he indicated to me that it can still be an important issue to be determined. Seems to me that it probably means that it arises more often at the casework stage rather than at the judicial stage. But if these matters come to court, it will be necessary for everybody to understand that decision, because what it does effectively is it broadens out the process of identifying whether a child is an Aboriginal for the purposes of the Act. Traditionally, there was a fairly rigid test which applied three particular tests to be satisfied, which related to the Land Rights Act and also land councils taking a part in the process. What this decision makes very clear is that a court can look now at a much wider range of material, and that's a significant thing in the Children's Court in particular, where the rules of evidence don't apply. And I think in that case, it was suggested that the court could even look at things like newspaper articles from over 100 years ago, which I think is really important. And it's really designed to look at not so much whether they have an ancestor who meets the definition of Aboriginal person, but to look really at the child themselves, and are they a child of Aboriginal descent? And in determining that question, the court is entitled to look at a whole range of material, using the example I just gave of newspaper articles and public records that go back a long time, to determine whether or not that child has a connection with Aboriginal groups. And from that perspective, I think it's a case which, whilst it's got some very technical aspects in it that need to be understood, probably more by the lawyers, everybody should read it, and perhaps it's one of those cases where an understanding of what it actually does is better understood by reading the case itself. But I think in summary, what it does say is the test for whether a child is Aboriginal for the purposes of Act is now capable of being determined in a much more simple way by reference to extrinsic materials that might be relevant to the history of the child and his ancestors or her ancestors.
And it overturned, well, it essentially said that an earlier decision of the Supreme Court had incorrectly defined the test, as Your Honour said, in terms of those three limbs. So it is a really important decision for a number of reasons. Karen, to round things out, can you give us some of your top tips for working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, if you can? How can we as practitioners, both representing parents and children, work in a culturally sensitive way with any clients that we might have?
I'm not sure if I have any dynamic top tips, but here are just some of my thoughts on that question. I think as practitioners, we need to have an understanding of the history of how child protection processes have impacted Aboriginal families. Like, we work in a system where we see tangible effects of child removal policies, and it's borne out in the community's distrust of the state and distrust of the courts, and also through the complexities and the impact that intergenerational trauma has for our families. Again, nothing specific to say about that, but I think it's something that we need to be aware of. And we need to be aware that the child protection process itself is traumatic for children and families, and particularly for Aboriginal families who have a history with child removals. So taking those things into consideration, I think that as practitioners, we need to be critical and understand what role we might play in adding to that trauma. So we sit down with clients and we take them over, you know, the case presented by the department. And that process in and of itself can be difficult for parents to navigate. So I think that we also need to make it clear to our clients that we're there to advocate for their interests. We're not part of the state. We're not part of the court. Our role is to listen to our clients, advise them, reality test them when we should, and act on their instructions and to bring their voice into a process that has traditionally ignored them. I think one of the biggest things we can do for Aboriginal families and the clients that we assist is to invest time and energy into the families that we serve. We need to recognise that because of things like intergenerational trauma, our clients are unlikely to give us the perfect instructions. You know, they're not going to give us instructions that flow through a chronological order that are easily digestible to us. So we need to take the time and sit down with our clients and hear from them. I liken it to the process of yarning. So for Aboriginal people, that's something that's important to us, and it's this reciprocal kind of process. And it's not necessarily just sitting down for a 10-minute conversation to get an instruction on the interim orders. I know from my own experiences, I will spend hours with clients just talking about discrete aspects of their case, and it's actually what's needed to provide a culturally appropriate service. So I don't know if they're hot tips. I don't know about that, but, you know, just some things to think about.
I think some of the best advice is simple, straightforward advice. It doesn't have to change the world. So fantastic tips, I think, Kyron. I'd like to thank you both for joining me today. We really hope that this session will allow you, the listeners, to be informed and culturally competent advocates for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families you will go on to represent.